Hi, I'm Bob Zimmerman, a general dentist in South Central Pennsylvania. I first learned of CMDA in 1977 when I was recruited on my first mission trip by my pastor just a month after dental school. It was with Medical Group Missions, the predecessor of GHO. I loved the experience and began yearly trips. In 1979, I had the privilege of working with James Scribner, who was in charge of the oral surgery residence for the Navy at Norfolk. Twice in the 80s, I spent 2 weeks on missions with Jim Haywood, retired chair of oral surgery at the University of Michigan. I learned much about surgery from those two men, but also how to integrate my faith and my profession. In 1983, Sue Genity, a dentist from Washington State, challenged me to start treating missionaries for free whenever they are home on leave. Soon I had many missionaries in my practice, and eventually they started recruiting me to go to their mission stations where there was medical care available, but not dental. This provided a wonderful opportunity to recruit other dental professionals, share my faith with those I served, and to give the missionaries a stronger voice with those they were trying to reach with the gospel. I was able to lecture in Moscow to Christian dentists in 1991 through Koyamia, the predecessor of MEI, and again in Ukraine in 1993. I have been on 58 mission trips over the last 44 years to 11 countries on 5 continents. I've been able to minister to my patients' spiritual needs as a result of the saline solution CMDA provided in the late 90s. I am just a general dentist in a small town, but through CMDA and the doors God opened, I have been blessed to serve Christ locally and globally over the last 44 years. Thank God for all CMDA has done in my life and allowed me to do for the kingdom. I encourage you to support CMDA, but also to take advantage of the many services and resources they provide. God bless you.
You are listening to CMDA Matters, the weekly podcast of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Chupp, and it is an incredible privilege to be the CEO, which I often describe as the role of Chief Exhortation Officer, of this 90-year-old organization. At CMDA, changing hearts in healthcare remains our primary passion because our vision is that our members and other Christian healthcare professionals that we influence on a regular basis may be bringing the hope and healing of Christ to the world every single day. The ability to be changed or transformed, and I believe the Greek word is metamorpho, from which we derive metamorphosis. Transformation is at the heart of the gospel of Jesus Christ. It is also at the heart of counseling and psychotherapy for those with unwanted same-sex attraction. Well, I've not yet had a professional counselor on CMDA Matters until today, when I invited one of the most educated and experienced PhD psychologists on the planet, Dr. Laura Haynes, who's a frequent speaker on issues related to sexuality, gender, and therapy. She's a trainer of trainers all across the globe on the hotly debated topic of sexual orientation change efforts. About 3 years ago, I got introduced to Laura by our VP of communications at that time, Margie Sheely, as Margie added me to Laura's email distribution list of more than 50 top Christian leaders and advocates for a biblically and evidence-based approach to understanding the SOGI issues of our day. And maybe you're not familiar with that acronym. SOGI stands for Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity. You may just want to listen to this 20-minute interview two or three times because she shares some really important evidence-based findings that the LGBTQ plus advocates are not likely to talk about. So let's listen in.
Well,
Well, I want to introduce you today to Dr. Laura Haynes, who's a psychologist retired from a clinical practice after more than 40 years of experience. Her degrees are in psychology and theology, and they include three master's degrees as well as a PhD. Wow, that's a lot of time in school. She's testified before legislative hearing committees in several states on bills, especially regarding sexuality and gender. Presently, she's an international political activist, a writer, and a speaker on issues related to sexuality, gender, and therapy. She has trained mental health providers all over the place, medical professionals, and activists from 27 countries, and presented to the United Nations and high-level government officials. Dr. Haynes is on the general board of the International Federation for Therapeutic and Counseling Choice and is the organization's USA country rep. She's a former regional president of the Christian Association for Psychological Studies. She serves on sexuality and gender research committees and task forces for several professional organizations. So I want to welcome you today. I've been waiting many months to have the opportunity to get to meet you and to have our listeners hear from Dr. Laura Haynes. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you, Mike. I'm so glad to have a chance to speak with you in person.
And because I wanted some help in making sure we ask all the right questions, I have invited our Senior Vice President, Dr. Jeff Barrows, Senior Vice President for Bioethics and Public Policy, as well as an OBGYN of more than a couple of decades. Welcome, Jeff.
It's good to be here, Mike. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I have a feeling, Dr. Haynes, that maybe a lot of our listeners have never heard about the International Federation of Therapeutic and Counseling Choice, and you're the country rep, and I just introduced you as someone who's been involved very much internationally on some of these issues. Tell us about your involvement with that international organization.
Okay, well, the International Federation for Therapeutic and Counseling Choice is, as the name might clue, an organization of therapists and pastors and former LGBTs, activists, and individuals who are interested in protecting the right to therapy that is open to change in sexual attraction or gender identity or expression. So we send statements to members of parliaments of countries, we and the United Nations. We train therapists and pastors all over the world in this, how to do this therapy and the science behind it.
So you have reps, Laura, all over the world, and basically in every country, you have counselors and pastors, as you say, who are well versed in change allowing therapy.
That's right.
And I noticed the motto for the Federation is supporting people who want to walk a different path. Before we kick into some of these questions that I wanted to ask you today, I bet you've had to deal with this whole issue over and over again of trying to help legislators and officials understand the difference between conversion therapy and change allowing therapy. So can you give our listeners how you respond every single time you hear this word conversion therapy?
It's a term that is usually undefined. It's coined by our opponents because they think that if therapy is made to sound like it's something religious, that that's a negative thing about it. So it's like the kitchen sink into which they can throw whatever they want. So they do research on conversion therapy, and these studies habitually will include therapists, pastors, parents, you name it, anybody. It could even just include saying a prayer one time. Anything that is a step towards change might be counted as conversion therapy. And then they, you know, have these studies with people who currently identify as LGBT, who are in LGBT organizations. So they haven't changed because people with change aren't in those organizations generally, and ask them leading questions and then say, you know, conversion therapy is dangerous. You know, even the American Psychological Association's task force report in 2009 said aversive methods have not been used by change-allowing therapists for 40 to 50 years, but they keep that alive. So it's really just an attempt to disparage any attempt to change and to make it sound like we're bad actors, and it's not representative of what we do or who we are.
A mutual friend of ours, Dr. Andre Van Mol, calls it a jamming technique. I think that's how he refers to it.
That's right. We just use standard methods, standard therapy methods.
So 40-year career, that's a long time in which you've been counseling. Has this been an issue for you that entire career, or is this something that has really just sort of cropped up in the last couple of decades of your counseling career?
Well, I would say the controversy around this therapy was very at the forefront in the 1990s, the early 1990s. That's when the National Association for Research in Therapy of Homosexuality began in the United States. The IFTCC is the international version of that organization, now the Alliance for Therapeutic Choice and Scientific Integrity. So at that time, we were getting soundings of attacks on what we do. It's grown, and by 2015, I was going to board meetings of a professional organization that had somebody come on board that was trying to ban the therapy in incremental steps. So I've seen how they do that procedure. It's not a scientific procedure, I assure you. And so, yeah, I've been dealing with it, I would say, heavily since 2015.
Well, Laura, I know that many of those who are opposed to what they call conversion therapy will often make the accusation that conversion therapy or anything that we are calling change-allowing therapy is harmful. And I'd like to have you address that and really answer the question, is same-sex attraction and incongruent gender identity unchangeable, or is it safe to at least attempt to change it with patients?
Well, first of all, I know of no professional organization that says sexual orientation or gender identity is simply biologically determined. I know plenty that say they are not. The American Psychological Association's APA Handbook of Sexuality and Psychology, for example, to which the American Psychological Association has given its imprimatur, it said its editors and authors are among its most respected members, and it declared the handbook authoritative. The handbook says sexual orientation and gender identity are not simply biologically determined. They have social causes, psychological causes. In fact, it says that childhood sexual abuse has associative and potentially causal links to having same-sex partners. They base that on research that includes a 30-year study of documented cases of childhood sexual abuse. They also said sexual orientation has psychoanalytic causes that can be standalone causes or in interaction with biological causes. And the handbook also says gender identity, it reviews research that suggests psychopathological causes. It was open to looking at those and reporting on them. So it's not only is it not biologically determined, it does change. Childhood gender dysphoria changes for the vast majority, according to several studies. And the British Psychological Society says it can changes at midlife and late in life. So lifelong gender identity can change. These change. And the British Psychological Society, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, say there can be psychopathological causes. And really, there's very strong research, I don't think many people know about, that shows that psychiatric disorders and neurodevelopmental disabilities and suicidality often precede, like 75% of the time or thereabouts, precede first medical evidence of thoughts about gender, and therefore may cause it. So there appears there's evidence that there are treatable psychological causes, at least for some people, and there's no reason why it should not be treatable through therapy. Like other traits that are not simply biologically determined, that have a combination of biological and psychological causes, should not be different in ability to treat.
So I got on the web last night, Dr. Haynes, and had a chance to look at the objects of the Association for the International Federation for Therapeutic and Counseling Choice, as well as guidelines for professionals and doing the appropriate kind of professional counseling, and clearly staying on top of evidence that comes out on these subjects of sexual orientation change efforts. It seems that there's a lot of literature that comes out from the other side, from LGBT ideology, that it doesn't work. A whole body of evidence. You've been looking at a lot of papers, a lot of journals over the course of the last decade plus. What are the techniques that the other side uses to substantiate whole ideas that suicidality is increased, you know, if you try to change? I've seen a lot coming from you and your friends who believe that change allowing therapy is the right thing to do. So what have you noticed?
Okay, well, I'd like to say some things about their research about therapy and ours. So as I said, it's typical for their studies to go to LGBT-identified venues and solicit participants. So automatically right there, they have omitted people who changed through therapy because people who changed don't go to those places, okay? Then they used biased questions. Has someone ever tried to make you change? Well, we don't do that. So these studies are not about change-allowing therapy because we don't do that. They may say be about adolescents. One study that's constantly quoted was about adolescents whose parents supposedly forced them to go to the therapy. We don't force anyone to be in therapy. Why would we? It wouldn't be any fun because it wouldn't work. We wouldn't want it. Why would we want to do that? So that's not about what we do either. And then they further biased questions. One of their favorite studies to reference asks people to rate their experience on a scale that gives them 3 negative options and 2 positive options. Is that biased? If they'd asked 3 positive questions, given 3 positive options and 2 negative options, might the results have been different? And furthermore, the scale measures 2 different factors. It's not even a consistent scale, so it's a poor study. This is one of their favorite ones to reference. So it's very poor, and it cannot prove anything. It is well known that people who identify as LGBT have high rates of mental disorders. Everyone agrees on that now. They didn't when they took homosexuality out of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. They said that they had no more pathology than anyone else. That's why they should be normal and taken out of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. But then it turned out in the 1990s with better research that, well, yes, they do have higher rates. So then the idea was brought forth, well, it's caused by they're not being affirmed and accepted. So anyway, the research is biased and poorly done. They only have associations that LGBT identity is associated with higher disorders. You cannot infer cause from that. And you can't say therapy is to blame for something that's already at high rates. Okay. Now, the 2 most comprehensive reviews of change-allowing therapy research, one by LGBT-affirming researchers for the American Psychological Association, and the other by change-affirming researchers in the U.S. Organization for Therapists Who Specialize in This, both reviews agree that people reported they changed sexual attraction, same-sex attraction and behavior and gender identity through therapy. They also agreed that there is no research that meets scientific standards, and specifically the American Psychological Association's scientific standards, that shows change-allowing therapy is harmful or ineffective. Now, most recently, like in the last 2 weeks, a study has come out which found that it was a study of men who wanted to change. 41% were married, nearly all of them with children, on average 3 children each. 88% were religious, attended church services once a week. So these represent the 2 most common reasons people want the therapy: to save their marriage and family, and to live according to the faith of their heart. It also found 72% decreased depression, 22% decreased suicidality, and few reported negative results. So this research gets overlooked.
Where was it published, Dr. Haynes?
It was published in an online peer-reviewed journal. I don't know it by memory, I'd have to look it up, but the authors are Sullins, Rosick, and Santero. Now, this study was previously published with different under using the same data set under different authors. And it got pulled from the Lineker Quarterly because somebody complained to the editor about the methods used. There was nothing wrong with the methods, but the editor felt that the journal did not have the expertise available to evaluate the question that was raised. The raw data has now been reevaluated, reprocessed using different statistics. It's very well done and written, and is available online. Sullins, Rosick, and Santero, 2021.
Well, Dr. Haynes, one of the other things that we're seeing happen across the country, unfortunately, especially in progressive states, is a move to codify or make it a state statute that schools engage in a particular type of sex education, and there's no question that that usually results in LGBT affirmation with students and medicine. And my question to you is, is there any evidence that this, because they're using this often as an argument, that it prevents mental health disorders and lowers suicide for gender incongruent or gender dysphoric children. Is there any evidence supporting that claim?
I don't know of any. And since there is evidence that these disorders precede thoughts of gender identity, it doesn't make sense. But it is dangerous. It is harmful because the APA Handbook of Sexuality and Psychology and the Endocrine Society, with its six co-sponsoring organizations, including the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, will caution that affirming children to live as another sex can lock them in, whereas otherwise the vast majority will naturally resolve these feelings if just left alone or supported to go through puberty. So what we're doing now in too many schools is we're starting with kindergartners and we're showing them cute little books that say there are many genders and they can create whatever gender they want, whatever they feel they are, and they can create pronouns that have never even been created before. So we are having children create gender identities. Or if they say they're not sure, then we're labeling them Q for questioning. Then they must, by law, where the comprehensive sex education, this approach is being used, must by law be affirmed. In fact, they can be affirmed to live as the other sex at school without their parents' knowledge or consent in California. Then, and when they're prepubescent, they're offered puberty blockers with the idea, well, this will give them more time to think of it, more pause. Well, what we find is that actually what these puberty blockers do is lock them in and virtually assure they will keep going. Children who otherwise would have resolved all of this, then put them on cross-sex hormones. So we're stripping of them of their fertility, of their sex, of sexual potentials for sexual pleasure and functioning, having children. This is child abuse. And then finally, you know, the cake is baked, they're done. And then as young adults, if they regret it and they come back and they actually do accept themselves and their bodily sex, what's gone is gone.
You know, Dr. Haynes, I think a lot of our listeners have probably heard from colleagues and others, or maybe read a paper about traditional religion actually causing people who identify as LGBT to increase their mental health and psychiatric problems. Is that true?
Most people don't realize there are several studies out in peer-reviewed journals published by gay LGBT affirmative researchers using a randomized, replicated, controlled trials showing that men who have sex with men can successfully and significantly reduce casual same-sex behavior, which is unwanted same-sex behavior for them. And the purpose of the therapy, which is done by gay affirmative therapists, is to reduce risk of HIV. And the men who, among those who were most successful in reducing their same-sex behavior that was unwanted were men who had children and men for whom having the idea of men having sex with men was inconsistent with their values. Again, people who may want to save their marriage and family and people who may want to live according to the religion of their heart. It's claimed that religion is harmful. Traditional faith is harmful to LGBT people. It's causing them mental health disorders and suicidality. Well, there is nationally representative research based on Pew Research data, population-based research, and research by an ideologically diverse team of LGBT-affirming researchers and change-affirming researchers working together that has found that people who live according to their same-sex feelings, who live according to their traditional faith, are no less happy, mentally healthy, satisfied with life, and flourishing than those of liberal faiths or no faith. An ideological change is not required.
Well, thank you for all you do, and thank you for joining us again today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to share.
Well, I hope you gained as much from that conversation as I did. I learned so much. I think it's a reasonable assessment of our current situation in mental health research that fair and impartial discussions about these topics have become extremely difficult. Labels of bigot and phobia and jamming techniques, like using the term conversion therapy, have been used as weapons by the LGBT lobby over the last decade. Dr. Haynes and many others like her continue to advocate that well-done empirical research suggests that change is not only possible, but a very attainable goal of mental health care by licensed and up-to-date counselors and therapists in our country and around the globe. Well, you might remember that last summer I had a guest on the program, Mr. George Carneal, who wrote the book From Queer to Christ. And in that book, George tells his story of living the gay life for many years and experiencing all of the pain and loss of that lifestyle before ultimately finding joy in Jesus Christ. It was such an insightful interview last summer, and his book is a most enlightening read. You can easily search in our CMDA Matters archives on our website, and again, the book title, From Queer to Christ, is on Amazon and several Christian bookstores. If you'd like to read an excellent treatise on the transgender identity topic, you should check out Ryan T. Anderson's book, When Harry Became Sally. That book was removed from Amazon recently, but it can still be found along with hundreds of other titles that we have handpicked for Christians in healthcare at the CMDA bookstore. Just go to cmda.org/store or call 888-230-2637 to purchase your copy today. The very topic of sexual identity is one of the most volatile issues of our modern culture. Dr. Christopher West, who was my recent guest on CMDA Matters, explains the importance of human sexuality beautifully in his book, Our Bodies Tell God's Story. I am pleased to announce that this book will be our June Book of the Month, and we would love to gift you a copy of that book for your donation of any amount to CMDA today. Your donation will also be matched dollar for dollar during our end-of-year giving campaign. Just go to cmda.org/ourbodiestellgodsstory. That's all one word, Our Bodies Tell God's Story, to make your donation today and receive your copy. Well, I'm so pleased of a work product that CMDA has just published new position statements on transgender identity and homosexuality on our CMDA website, which were highlighted in a recent article in Christianity Today from May 19th, which was entitled, Is It Discrimination or Do No Harm? Christian Doctors Gear Up for Transgender Debates. And that was an interview with our Senior Vice President for Bioethics and Public Policy, Dr. Jeff Barrows. I think that these are some of the most comprehensive statements available anywhere. They were developed by our Ethics Committee in 2020 and then approved by our Board of Trustees and our House of Representatives earlier this year. They were developed with healthcare professionals like you in mind, but you can share them with your pastor or your church lay leaders, as these statements incorporate biblical truth together with science and healthcare research. I hope that you will find them helpful in developing your own thinking and your own approach to patients and colleagues and your community, where you know that you have such great influence as a healthcare professional. Well, today I owe a great big thank you to many of you who've been responding to help claim the $250,000 matching gift that I announced last month. The gifts of our members and champions in May helped us claim $160,000 of that match and getting us closer to our $700,000 fiscal year-end giving goal. Your response has been so encouraging to me, but we still have a ways to go. If you've been delaying your response to give, I would be most grateful if you would take a few minutes to consider your gift today. I am sure that you make it your goal every day to provide holistic care for your patients, and this process can begin with your first patient encounter by including a spiritual history in your initial health history interview. Dr. Andrew Way from Loma Linda University shows how we can easily make this a regular part of our patient interactions, and then to open the door to future spiritual interventions. To watch this particular episode of Faith Prescriptions, just check out the new curriculum on the CMDA Learning Center by going to cmda.org/learning or click on the link in the show notes today. Well, if you like CMDA Matters, this weekly podcast, and you'd like to make it more accessible to other Christian doctors, give us a thumbs up in your favorite podcast platform and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a new weekly program. Also, feel free to share a favorite conversation with one of my past guests on social media and help increase our exposure to other Christian healthcare professionals, whether they are members or not. Well, as I close, I want to encourage you to tune in next week as I have two guests in our Bristol studio, Dr. Steve Sartori, who is the retiring director of the CMDA Center for Wellbeing, and his successor, our newest senior leader at CMDA here in Bristol, Pastor Bert Jones. He was the Bible teacher at our recent national convention, and he has now accepted the position of CMDA Director of Leadership and Church Relations. I want to thank you for listening today. We will catch you next week, God willing.
This podcast has been a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members, and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.